Today is Monday, December 19th, 2011. I'm Martin Lumlin.
And I'm Chirag Mahajan. You're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting to you live from the Student Union Building at the University of British Columbia, to the UBC campus, the residence of Vancouver, and to listeners of our newscast and podcast on the internet.
Right here on News 101.
Right here on News 101.
What motivated you to become a candidate in the provincial election?
The media portrayal of last week's protest that resulted in polarizing images of black-clad activists taken to the streets.
He was just explaining to us the reason why they wanted to show this film on campus.
The official stance is that we are for the Olympics.
News 101 reporter Brad Pepping was there.
By discriminating against homeless people in Vancouver, there's a disproportionate impact on Aboriginal people as well as people with disabilities.
I was pretty outraged. I mean, it is outrageous.
In-depth coverage from an alternative perspective.
You're listening to News 101, Vancouver's only live, volunteer-produced, student and community newscast, offering you local, national, and international news from an alternative perspective.
What's left of us? Just a big mistake. There's nothing more for any.
Good evening, it is 5:06 and time for another full hour of independent news. Our headlines will cover local news from around Vancouver, provincial and federal news from across Canada, as well as news from around the world.
All this plus your weekday weather forecast right here on News 101, your source for independent, local, national, and international news. And now for our local headlines.
The BC government says it has now implemented all of the recommendations for the police use of tasers as a result of the inquiry into the death of Robert Zikansky, at Vancouver Airport 4 years ago. Solicitor General Shirley Bond says that she has approved new policing standards for the weapons, and the rules will apply to all officers working in BC, including the RCMP. These new standards come from the Braidwood Commission, which examined the incident in which Zikansky died after being struck several times with a taser during a confrontation with four RCMP officers at Vancouver Airport in 2007. The commission recommended that police get better training on tasers, that the weapons only be used if there is a danger that a suspect will cause bodily harm, and that officers be trained in crisis management.
This Sunday in the downtown east side, the Lotus Light Charity Society donated 500 sleeping bags to the Vancouver Police Department's Homeless Outreach Program, which is in its fourth year. An eager lineup formed on East Hastings outside the Lotus Light Charity Society, even before the society officially announced the sleeping bag giveaway. Jodine Keller, the Vancouver Police Department's Homeless Outreach Coordinator, Buddhist Master Lian Zi of the Lotus Light Society, and Vancouver City Councillors Kerry Jiang and Tony Tang kicked off the event by giving out 175 sleeping bags to the expectant queue. Lotus Light has been running a winter charity drive for the past 16 years, distributing sleeping bags and emergency care packages in partnership with local shelters and family service agencies through the Lower Mainland.
RCMP have seized $1.15 million worth of counterfeit banknotes from the Richmond apartment. Stacks of holograms and a counterfeit foil strip were also seized from the apartment at Alderbridge Way, along with a computer, printer, an embosser, and stacks of blank credit cards. Inspector Ian Lawson of the Federal RCMP Commercial Crimes Section says the notes would likely have been ready by Christmas, a time when it's easy to pass fake bills and credit cards because retailers are quite busy. Four men in their early 20s were arrested. One remains in custody, while the other three will appear in court next month. The men are believed to be a part of an organized crime ring. They face charges of making and producing counterfeit money and possessing instruments to make counterfeit notes.
The Vancouver Police Department recommended another 52 charges against 20 people this morning. If the charges are approved by the Crown, it will bring the total number of alleged Stanley Cup rioters charged to 47. Vancouver Police Inspector Les Yeo said this new wave of charges is just the beginning, saying, quote, we will charge as many people as we can. I would say that the majority of the charges will be in the early part of 2011, end quote. So far, 8 of the accused have made their first appearances in court. Vancouver police said that they expect anywhere between 500 and 700 people to face charges when all is said and done.
For 2 years now, the Cohen Commission has been examining causes of the 2009 collapse of Fraser River sockeye salmon. But just as the 21-month inquiry was wrapping up, there came suggestion that an influenza-like virus had infiltrated BC waters, which prompted the commissioner to hold 3 additional days of hearings, the last of which took place today. Fred Kebenge, a scientist who runs a reportedly prestigious lab on the East Coast in PEI, detected the virus in 2 of 48 sockeye smolts, and these results were widely publicized in October. Since then, it seems like the Canadian Food Inspection Agency and a few government officials have done everything in their power to stifle these findings, manipulating the public relations tide in their favor, trying desperately to discredit scientists who have made it their life's work to find out why the Fraser River salmon are dwindling in numbers. Professor Rick Routledge of SFU came under some scrutiny after he made Kibbinge's results public. He'd collected and sent them to Ribbinge's PEI lab for testing, but the CFIA removed all samples from Routledge's freezer, essentially putting an end to his work. And then there's molecular geneticist Christy Miller, who runs a research lab for the Fisheries Department in Nanaimo. Miller also found the ISA virus in BC salmon and was almost instantly alienated by her superiors. Although Miller found the ISA virus in BC salmon, she claims this isn't even her biggest concern. Miller also found signs of another virus, unknown in Canadian fish, that causes a condition called heart and skeletal muscle inflammation. Miller, along with 5 other expert fish scientists, have all shared with the inquiry varying evidence that the ISA, and possibly other unknown viruses, may very well be carried in BC salmon, some findings dating back 25 years. The ISA virus has infected and killed millions of fish in Chile, and is believed to have originated in Norway, where its own stocks were devastated. The inquiry's final report is due by the end of June. Now here to help us understand what went on behind the doors of the Cohen Commission today, we go to Dr. Craig Orr, who is the Executive Director of Watershed Watch, for his observations on the hearings.
I've been here for 18 months, and I think the last 2 days so far anyways, and the third to come, are probably the most interesting so far in terms of the evidence around how Canada protects wild salmon from disease outbreaks and transmission from salmon farms. There's been lots of evidence to suggest that there is infectious salmon anemia in British Columbia. 3 different labs, we heard evidence from, tested positive for ISA in farmed and wild salmon in British Columbia, and one of those labs is a DFO, Fisheries and Oceans Lab, and so the evidence, I think, is pretty strong, despite the recent denial of the government that there's ISA in British Columbia, that in fact it is here in British Columbia. When the evidentiary hearings ended in the fall of 2011, we were assured that there's no ISA in British Columbia. But just a couple weeks after the hearings closed, there were reports of ISA in juvenile sockeye in British Columbia that were sent in and tested by Simon Fraser University. So the hearings have been reopened, and we've since found that Department of Fisheries and Oceans has found infectious salmon anemia in farmed and wild salmon in British Columbia. And that's quite a finding. So, we had a lot of denial by government that ISA was in British Columbia. In fact, just as recently as a December 2nd, 2011, press release from Fisheries Minister Keith Ashfield saying there's no ISA in British Columbia. But incidentally, that press release that was sent out came after the Department of Fisheries and Oceans found ISA in salmon and briefed, their scientists internally. So good evidence that we have ISA in not only sockeye, but in farmed Chinook in British Columbia at this time.
What about that other virus that you just reported yesterday?
Another virus, yeah. Well, it sounds like we probably are sort of uncovering a lot of different things in British Columbia, but we also heard from Christy Miller, head of DFO Genomics, yesterday in the Cohen Inquiry, that she found a Piscine Reovirus, which is responsible for heart and skeletal fetal muscle inflammation in salmon, and fairly high mortality rates in farm salmon, at least in places in the world where salmon are farmed, and we find HSMI, and have to be concerned that those kind of diseases might get into wild fish. Lots of hosts in salmon farms. Our salmon farms in British Columbia are extremely large, maybe 750,000 fish crammed into a little net pen. These farms, as science has shown around the world, are ideal places where you get the crowding of hosts and you get the development and transmission and mutations of diseases in these farms that can then affect wild fish that pass by these open net cages. We have seen lots of compelling evidence that there are a lot of things impacting sockeye in the Fraser River. Certainly there's evidence that sea lice can impact wild fish. We don't have a lot of firm evidence on sockeye, but certainly fish as large as sockeye, juveniles have been impacted by sea lice in other parts of the world. And coho salmon, which are much larger as juveniles than pink salmon, which have been impacted by sea lice on this coast. So it's not beyond the realm of possibility that sea lice impact Fraser sockeye. It certainly seems that there are other things that are impacting sockeye. They have all kinds of stresses in different parts of their life history. Thermal stress when they come back, farm stress around the coast, food stress, and there's also evidence presented at Cohen that sockeye are being outcompeted by juvenile pink salmon, in the ocean as well. It's probably going to be difficult to pin this decline on just one cause, but what we need to do is control what we can in terms of what's impacting Fraser sockeye, and we can control, into a large degree, the impacts of disease that are coming from salmon farms if we get the farms out of the way of the wild sockeye. And the same with sea lice, get the farms out of the way of wild sockeye, put the farms on land, and we're probably going to be getting rid of a large problem that has caused the decline of wild fish around the world.
Those are your local headlines. We're going to take a quick break, but stay with us. You're listening to News 101 here on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting live from the University of British Columbia in Vancouver.
Do you need someone to talk to? If you're seeking a listener who is non-judgmental, confidential, and familiar with resources, then a Speakeasy volunteer might be able to help you. AMS Speakeasy is a peer support service located in the North Concourse of the Sub. If you would like to speak to someone, come to the desk and tell a volunteer, or ring the doorbell located behind the desk.
And welcome back to News 101. I'm Martin Lumlin.
And I'm Chirag Mahajan. You're listening to News 101. You're listening to us on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver, or online at citr.ca, broadcasting live from the University of British Columbia. Thank you for being with us. It is now time for the national news.
Quebec has made a large step towards acknowledging and rectifying climate change. The province announced last week that it will immediately join California in enforcing cap-and-trade regulations for carbon emissions. Starting on January 1st, Quebec will allow a one-year transition period to help big emitters adjust to the new system, which will officially kick in at the beginning of 2013. This program applies to large industrial emitters and requires them to reduce their carbon footprint or buy clean air credits. This program is being run under the Western Climate Initiative, whose objective it is to reduce carbon emissions 15% below 2005 levels by 2020. It would appear, however, that the battle against climate change could be a lonely one these days. The Western Climate Initiative was originally signed by 7 U.S. states and 4 Canadian provinces. All of the U.S. states, save California, have pulled out, and it's still unclear whether any Canadians other than Quebec will go ahead with enforcing the cap-and-trade system.
Natural Resources Minister Joe Oliver said last week that construction on the $9 billion Joslyn North Oil Sands project can now begin, 65 kilometers northwest of Fort McMurray in the Athabasca Oil Sands region in northern Alberta. The Joslyn project is slated to be up and running at full production by 2017. At full capacity, it will produce 100,000 barrels of bitumen a day. Total estimates are that the mine will yield more than 874 million barrels over its 20-year lifespan. It has been 6 years since the Jocelyn North project was proposed by Total E&P Canada, which is the time it took for regulatory approval and an environmental assessment. However, a two-week consultation period with local First Nations groups still has to be completed, which begs the question as to whether or not the environmental assessment even took this portion of the public into consideration.
Today, every finance minister in the land met up in Victoria to discuss the future of federal funding on healthcare and pensions. Although it seems as though the distribution of funds regarding our healthcare system commandeered the meeting. Canada's health accord will expire in 2014, and many political heavies are wary that the Conservative government will try to shuffle the financial burden onto the provinces. Today, provincial finance ministers were told that 6% healthcare funding increases will continue every year until 2016-17. After that, the annual increase will be tied up to the nominal GDP, but will be guaranteed at a minimum of 3%. To be honest, I'm not really sure what this means. What's more important, I think, is the fact that half the country's provincial finance ministers felt it necessary to stand together and denounce the way in which the federal government is choosing to go about addressing the renewal of our health accord. Here's Quebec's finance minister, Raymond Bachand, and Ontario finance minister, Dwight Duncan, explaining how it all went down today.
I asked Jim Flaherty, and we asked that maybe we should discuss about it. This was on a discussion during lunch in the agenda. Okay, well, we'll talk about that over our sandwiches at lunchtime. And then what happened, Dwight?
He put the document in front of us, said this is how it's going to be. And that's just no way to do business.
And
yes, it'll be built into future federal budgets under the guise of, you know, predictability of future financing. Well, what I can predict on this is that all Ontarians eventually will see a real diminution in the quality health care that we are able to offer. And to the last question, there are a number of Conservative MPs in Ontario who need to know that whether you live in Windsor or London or Kitchener Waterloo or Ottawa or Thunder Bay or Sudbury or any of our small rural hospitals, this means less service. It means less home care. It means less nurses. It put greater pressure on provincial budgets. We have those challenges too, and that's why we were hoping that we could have the opportunity to work together.
Minister, you were talking, you asked the Prime Minister about your statement that this is moving away from a campaign promise, and he almost scoffed and laughed at that. What's your reaction to that?
We put out the video last week. I'll make sure you get a copy of it. There's a bit of revisionist history going on here. And listen, I acknowledge the challenge they have fiscally. We have as big a challenge. And what I simply think needs to happen, I think what you're hearing from a bunch of ministers, all of whom are wrestling with their own challenges, is that working together the way we have historically makes more sense than just to unilaterally come in, put something down and say, this is how it's going to be for the next, 14 or 15 years. And again, 6% is large relative to growth in the economy. It is not large relative to changing demographics, relative to increasing utilization rates, relative to new technologies. And so when one level of government, which is supposed to be a 50% funder, unilaterally pulls back still further, that should cause all Canadians a concern, particularly those Canadians who are socialization allows to provide and so on. So I hope that perhaps the first ministers do and get this thing so we can work there. Because we've got a lot of, I think we all agreed today, we got a lot of great things going on in Canada. When you look at where we are relative to the rest of the world, and we've done that together, you know, we worked through the downturn together. I think that's the way Canadians want us to approach it.
But not everyone denounced the feds. BC's finance minister Kevin Falcon seemed to think the proposed changes were pretty fair. He pointed to global financial instability and said that Canada has to be responsible and maintain its strong reputation. But many feel that in order to maintain our reputation, we need to maintain the fair and ridiculously decent healthcare system that lent us that reputation. Now here's Ontario's Dwight Duncan explaining what he sees to be the difference between the old system we've grown accustomed to and the new incoming tide.
based on inflation. It was based on a whole range of factors, including utilization, the changing demographic of society. It's simply not adequate to look at healthcare in the context of one measure, whether it's nominal GDP or whatever that measure happens to be. So that accord was negotiated over 10 years. Today, and the health the social transfer was negotiated along the same basis, equalization the same way. Today, the federal government announced unilaterally that they are moving forward for roughly the next 16 years on how they're going to fund health care, equalization, and the social transfer, which is an important component of each one of these provinces' income statements and balance sheets. They're moving unilaterally without any discussion with respect to how we're going to fund health care, how we're going to make sure that all provinces can provide an equal level of services with respect to how we fund social services. You know, for instance, if you look at the Ontario press release, by putting that floor in, they've actually raised the amount they can take out over the next accord from $21 billion to $30 billion, $36 billion, okay, because when you put a floor in that low, and that's why these numbers are a little bit complex, what you saw there was a dramatic removal of the federal government from healthcare funding over the period that commences roughly in 2016 to 2027, unequivocally. And historically, the federal government was supposed to occupy about 50%. Today, when you factor in, as I say, tax points and cash transfers, it's 33%. What does that mean for your readers, your viewers? It means less access to quality health care from C to C to C in French and in English, in Ontario, Quebec, all of these provinces. For a number of organization is equally important, and I'll let them speak to it, but the principle of equalization is to ensure that all provinces can offer roughly equal public services. And what you saw today was, in my view, unprecedented, certainly in adult life. I don't recall anything quite like this. And it means that they have decided, again, unilaterally to move forward. It means still more difficult choices for all the provinces affected. And I don't think you've heard the end of this, because I think Canadians and Quebecers will understand what this means directly. And so First Ministers will be meeting the Council of the Federation next month. We are going to continue to press the case for a different approach to the Federation. We agree and concur that we all have to get back to balance. We're all doing that in our own ways with our own challenges that are unique. But when one level of government does this, without consultation, I don't ever recall the Canadian population standing up together like this and just angry at protest number one, but more importantly, in the long term on substance. We're seeing the federal government effectively take itself further out of health care, which I call Canadians' values as extremely important.
An ex-bishop's lawyer argued vehemently that their client is not a pedophile at a sentencing hearing today in Ottawa. Raymond Leahy, former head of the Diocese of Antigonish, Nova Scotia, pleaded guilty earlier this year to possession of child pornography after he was arrested at the Ottawa airport with hundreds of pornographic images of children on his computer. Leahy's lawyers are seeking the minimum sentence of 1 year plus 1 year probation and are asking for a 2-to-1 credit for time already served. Leahy's been in jail since pleading guilty in May. Dr. John Bradford, the psychiatrist who assessed Leahy for both the Crown and defense, said that the former bishop is not a pedophile and presents virtually no risk to commit a hands-on sexual offense. According to the doctor, a pedophile is someone who is attracted to children under the age of 13 for more than 6 months, but Leahy has a homosexual interest in adolescent males aged 14 to 17, as well as sadomasochistic interests, which is very strange for a bishop, in my opinion. Crown lawyers will argue their case tomorrow morning at 10.
Those are your national headlines. You're listening to News 101 here on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting live from the Student Union Building at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver.
The alphabet has only 26 letters. With these 26 magic symbols, however, millions of words are written every day.
Pick up your winter issue of Discorder, as the Jan-cember issue is packed with goodies that will warm even the coldest of cockles. Take a dip with Dixie's Death Pool, a spacey art rock collective, or read up on local outsider pop music makers, World Club. Cozy up on the couch with Filmstripped, featuring a review of Color Me Obsessed, a documentary on The Replacements. And in case you missed the memo, 2012 is almost here. Check out the Discorder album picks of 2011. Don't forget to pick up your special Jan-Sember issue of Discorder.
Welcome back to News 101 here on CITR 101.9 FM. Thank you for being with us. It is now time for the international news. According to a recent report, the official death toll of the tropical storm that devastated several provinces of the Philippines rose to 927. Benito Ramos, head of the Office of Civil Defense, said additional bodies were unfortunately being retrieved from the ocean as well. After as much as 20 centimeters of rain fell within 24 hours, the hardest hit regions are faced with no electricity or clean drinking water, and some residents are calling the disaster unprecedented. About 143,000 people were affected in 13 southern and central provinces of the Philippines, including 45,000 who have fled to evacuation centers. About 7,000 houses were swept away, destroyed or damaged, the Office of Civil Defense said. An estimated 35% of evacuees are children, said Trevor Clark, head of UNICEF in the southern Mindanao region. Authorities have begun distributing food rations for 10,000 families, as well as blankets and mosquito nets, but are appealing for clean drinking water, food, and dry clothes to be sent to the thousands who have been displaced by this disaster.
A Russian drilling rig with a crew of 67 capsized and sank this Sunday while being towed through the icy sea of Okhotsk. The water temperature was 1 degree Celsius, which left rescuers with a 30-minute window in which to save the crew. Only 14 of the crew were rescued. Four suffering from hypothermia were airlifted to hospital immediately. There is no reported danger to ecological life, as the vessel was carrying minimum fuel because it was being towed. Poor infrastructure and corner cutting has led to several Russian sea disasters in the last decade, including the sinking of a nuclear submarine in 2000, in which all 118 crew members died.
The opposition leader of the Democratic Republic of the Congo, Etienne Tshisekedi, who insists he won the recent election, is calling for the arrest of incumbent president and declared winner Joseph Kabila. According to the Congo News Agency, Tshisekedi said, quote, "I consider myself from this day on the president elected by the Congolese people," end quote, telling his supporters to look for Kabila, saying, quote, "Wherever he's in the country, bring him to me alive." On December 9th, the country's election commission declared Kabila, age 40, the winner, and he's slated to be sworn in for another term on Tuesday. Kabila has been ruling the country since he took over from his father, who was assassinated in 2001. A number of independent observers, including the U.S. State Department and the Carter Center, said the elections were flawed or not done properly. The polls were the first independently run election in the country since the end of a nasty civil war and the bloody aftermath, which left 4 million people dead.
Sweden's national Twitter account is now being run by a different citizen each week as part of a program called Curators of Sweden. No one owns the brand of Sweden more than its people. With this initiative, we let them show their Sweden to the world, says Thomas Bruhl, CEO of Visit Sweden, the tourism ministry that has been updating the @Sweden account since January 2009. Visit Sweden says it chose the curators because they represent the country's values and skills, including gay rights, fashion, design, and innovation.
In some hilarious European news, a large model of an American jet fighter has mysteriously disappeared from a small Dutch museum, and its owners are hoping pranksters, rather than scrap metal thieves, are responsible for this theft. Edwin van Brachel, chairman of the museum Vliegbasis Delen, says the non-working model of a Lockheed Starfighter was discovered missing Sunday morning. On Monday, he said it is a mystery how thieves managed to move the scale of the jet fighter, which is about 10 meters or 33 feet long and weighs about 500 kilograms or 1,100 pounds. Von Brachel said it looks like the theft was a prank because of a note left at the scene that translated as, quote, "Fly away, see you next year." We just hope that these stoners give that model plane back soon and not try to make a flying getaway.
Those are your international headlines. For more international headlines, we shall go to Free Speech Radio News.
I'm Nell Abram with FSRN Headlines. The U.S. House of Representatives takes up a bill today that would extend both the payroll tax cut and unemployment benefits for just 2 months. House Republicans largely oppose the bill, which the Senate passed 89-10 on Friday before leaving D.C. for the holidays. House Speaker John Boehner explains why he expects the bill to fail in tonight's vote.
The idea that tax policy can be done 2 months at a time is the kind of activity that we see here in Washington that's really put our economy off its tracks. It's time for Congress to do its work, and no more kicking the can down the road.
The House version of the bill would extend the payroll tax cut for a full year, but cut the length of unemployment benefits and restrict eligibility. Both the Senate and House bills include a provision to fast-track a presidential decision on the Keystone XL pipeline. Boehner said the issue will likely go to conference to resolve the differences, which would force the Senate to return. If Congress can't agree on a bill before December 31st, millions of Americans could receive smaller paychecks in January. Local leaders in West Africa gathered to pledge an end to female genital mutilation. Alpha Jallo reports from Senegal.
At a ceremony in the town of Bakel, more than 1,000 people from small villages in eastern Senegal and neighboring Mali vowed never to perform female genital mutilation again. To the astonishment of the crowd, one elderly woman revealed that she has performed the operation on 999 girls. The procedure involves removing the clitoris of young girls. The woman promised to hang up her blade and never perform the procedure again. Usman Silla works with Tosdan, an NGO outreach program in eastern Senegal, waging a campaign against female genital mutilation. A traditional practice deeply rooted in this part of the country and in the Republic of Mali. Local leaders at the event also agreed to end the practice of early and forced marriages. Alpha Jallo, Free Speech Radio News, Bakel, Eastern Senegal.
The UN General Assembly officially condemned Syria's state-sponsored crackdown of pro-democracy dissidents today. The non-binding resolution calls for the state to release political prisoners and remove military forces from the streets. In Cairo today, Syrian officials did sign an Arab League proposal to allow observers into the country, but only after negotiating fewer observers for a limited period of 1 month.
After two weeks in jail, Syrian
blogger Razan Ghazaoui, also known as Red Razan, was freed on bail. But reports from the ground reveal continuing violence, with at least another 15 people killed today. In the Philippines, mass burials were held for hundreds of unidentified victims of a typhoon over the weekend. Madonna Varola has more.
Instead of the traditional preparations for Christmas, residents of Cagayan de Oro and Iligan cities in the southern Philippines are cleaning up and rebuilding after killer tropical storm Washi surprised them Saturday morning. As of Monday, 652 people are confirmed dead, 911 others still missing. Some 47,000 remain in evacuation centers. Local officials prepared sites for mass burials of unclaimed, decomposing bodies after funeral parlors said they could not accommodate more victims. Health officer Didi Villarin said the cadaver bags would be marked with physical features of the body for possible exhumation. According to the Department of Environment and Natural Resources, the huge amount of rainfall coupled with denuded mountains and forests caused flash floods, creating what the agency called critical conditions in communities across the region. Madonna Virola, FSRN, Calapan City, the Philippines.
NATO officials said today they will continue to conduct controversial nighttime raids. Despite calls from Afghan President Hamid Karzai to end the home invasions, Brigadier General Karsten Jacobsen says the actions are the safest way to remove militant leaders. Further, he noted that Afghan special forces are increasingly involved in the operations, where troops force their way into Afghans' homes during the night. One such raid on Saturday resulted in the detention of three men and the death of one woman. She was 8 months pregnant. Václav Havel, the former president of the Czech Republic, died Sunday. The writer, dissident, and politician played a prominent role in Charter 77, which led to the Velvet Revolution and the end of the Communist Party's total control of the country. His influential essay, The Power of the Powerless, described to opposition movements around the world how to thrive within and thereby weaken the repressive systems that denied them rights. The essay ends, "For the real question is whether the brighter future is really always so distant. What if, on the contrary, it has been here for a long time already, and only our own blindness and weakness has prevented us from seeing it around us and within us, and kept us from developing it?" Havel was 75. For FSRN from Tampa, Florida, I'm Nell Abram.
Today, thousands of North Koreans filled the streets of the capital Pyongyang in mourning of the country's longtime leader, Kim Jong-il. State media reported he died of a heart attack on Saturday, but details remain unclear. Kim Jong-il officially took over power from his father in 1994, but was a central figure in the communist leadership since the mid-1970s. North Korea's isolated regime is nuclear-armed, and neighboring countries have expressed concern heading into a period of transition. Some human rights groups are pressing for an improvement in relations in order to address widespread poverty and hunger. According to Amnesty International, nearly a million people have died in North Korea due to food shortages since the mid-1990s. Chronic malnutrition continues to hit millions more, especially women and children. For more on the local reaction, we go to FSRN's Jason Struther in Seoul, South Korea. Jason, what has been the response like in South Korea to the news of Kim Jong-il's death?
Well, despite North Korea being a nuclear-armed state without a ruler at the moment, most South Koreans that I've spoken to seem very calm. The fact of the matter is, many here don't feel that what happens above the 38th parallel has any real impact on their lives. South Korea's president, Lee Myung-bak, has said that people should remain calm, go about their daily business, and that's pretty much what they did.
Now, Kim Jong-il's weakening health has been reported on in the last few years. Any more details about the circumstances of his death?
For about 3 years now, there had been talk about how Kim had suffered a stroke, had brain surgery, may have even had pancreatic cancer, was a diabetic. So it shouldn't be too much of a surprise that at age 69 or 70, Kim finally succumbed to his health problems. North Korean media is saying it was a heart attack brought on by the exhaustion that Kim endured trying to improve the nation. I think without medical records, it would be impossible for the outside world to know whether, in fact, it was a heart attack that killed him or some other health-related issue.
You mentioned South Korea's President Lee Myung-bak calling on people to continue about their business, but there must be some thought about the future and how this event could affect things and relations moving forward. One of the most pressing issues is the reunification of families who have been divided since the war. Is there any indication at this point of how Kim Jong-il's death could affect that process of reunification?
There's been no talk yet related to the family reunions issue. Of course, for the past few months, the Unification Ministry here, the government body that handles all matters with the North, has been pressing for the resumption of these inter-Korean family reunions. The Red Cross here keeps requesting these get-togethers to be held, but Pyongyang pretty much routinely has denied that for the past year. Kim's death could possibly start some movement in the North to have these get-togethers held, but one of the main problems, one of the main obstacles standing in the way of these reunions is that the venue that many of them have been held over the past decade has been seized by the North Korean government this year. There's a lot of controversy at the Mount Geumgang Resort, where South Korean tourists once visited. So I think until matters get resolved there at the resort, it would be very difficult at the moment for any more reunions to take place.
Looking ahead, Kim Jong-il's son, Kim Jong-un, has been mentioned as a successor. What's his leadership likely to be like, and what does this transition of power look like?
Well, we still don't know very much about Kim Jong-un. He's believed to be in his late 20s, educated abroad in Switzerland, and all of a sudden last year he was appointed as a four-star general. Analysts do hope that his Western education might mean that he'll be more open to engagement with the international community. But I think the fact that he is so young and inexperienced indicates that there might be figures either in North Korea's Workers' Party, the military, or both who are actually pulling the strings from behind the scenes. North Korea has not officially said that Kim Jong-un is going to take over, although he has risen up in the North Korean Workers' Party and Defense Commission in recent months, and he's been appointed as the head of his father's funeral commission. So he definitely is taking a prominent role. Of course, Kim Jong-il himself inherited power from his father, Kim Il-sung, back in 1994, but it was 3 years until he was officially named as the chairman of the Defense Commission and Workers' Party, which pretty much is equivalent to the prime leadership in North Korea.
That's FSRN's Jason Strother in Seoul, South Korea. Jason, thank you.
Thank you.
The pretrial hearing for Private First Class Bradley Manning continued over the weekend as his supporters rallied outside the gates of Fort Meade, Maryland. Officials have restricted media and public access to the trial, in which government prosecutors seek a life sentence for Manning for passing over 250,000 classified documents to WikiLeaks. FSRN's Alice Olstein has the story.
Let Bradley go! Hey, hey! Ho-ho!
Participants from Occupy Wall Street, Occupy DC, and Occupy Newark marched alongside veterans and activists from across the U.S. at Saturday's rally, calling for Bradley Manning's release.
Let Bradley go! Hey,
hey! 21-year-old Michael Patterson is with Iraq Veterans Against the War and participates in Occupy DC. Though he pledges to keep supporting Manning as his case moves along, he has little faith in the proceedings.
It's pretty much a show trial. Like, I mean, when the president of the United States says that you're already guilty, tell me which officer is going to say to the commander-in-chief, the head of the entire military, no, Mr. President, you're incorrect. That's so much added pressure. That's literally like, you know, the emperor telling you, don't do this.
At a campaign fundraiser in April, President Obama was caught on camera telling a reporter that Manning, quote, broke the law, months before the trial to determine that began. Manning's defense team requested that President Obama, along with Secretary of State Hillary Clinton and other officials, testify at the hearing. But investigating officer Paul Almanza denied nearly all of the defense team's requested witnesses, a decision Manning's lawyer has vowed to appeal. While some are skeptical of the military judicial system, others say it could shed light on underlying issues in military intelligence. Anne Wilcox is an attorney and legal observer with the National Lawyers Guild.
Hopefully they'll make an effort to not just go with the, you know, the publicity that he's, you know, a traitor and helping the enemy and give it a fair look, and also look carefully at the overclassification issues, because I think that's really what the case is going to turn on, is whether this was really secret at all.
On Friday, Manning's lawyer began the hearing by demanding that investigating officer Almanza recuse himself from the case. The defense team argued that serving as a prosecutor for the Justice Department, the agency currently pursuing a case against WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange, made Almanza biased. When he refused to step down from judging the case, Manning's lawyer promised to appeal. The hearing has also put a spotlight on Manning's sexual orientation. Defense lawyers told the military court that Manning was emotionally unstable, suffering from gender identity disorder, and should not have been allowed to handle sensitive information in the first place. Captain Stephen Lim, one of Manning's superiors in Baghdad, testified that Manning should have had his security clearance revoked after a series of pre-deployment outbursts in which Manning threw a chair and assaulted a supervisor. And on Monday, the defense team questioned Manning's former Baghdad roommate, who said he stopped speaking to Manning after discovering he was gay. Several gay veterans were among those at Saturday's rally, including Lieutenant Dan Choi. Following his discharge from the Army for his sexual orientation, Choi became one of the most public figures in the successful push to repeal Don't Ask, Don't Tell. Choi says Manning's treatment at the hands of the military has been far more criminal than his actions.
When you strip away habeas corpus, and when you judge somebody before trial, when you confine them for a year and a half, when you strip them naked, when you torture them and try to get forced confessions, that is an assault on the Constitution.
Manning was held at the Quantico, Virginia brig for 10 months, much of that time in near total isolation. After thousands of supporters petitioned and protested, he was moved to Fort Leavenworth, Kansas, where his lawyers say his conditions greatly improved. United Nations torture expert Juan Mendez recently called for a worldwide ban of solitary confinement longer than 15 days, saying the practice causes lasting mental damage and amounts to torture. Veteran Michael Patterson, who also worked in military intelligence, says the pretrial conditions and many charges against Manning are meant to scare other potential whistleblowers.
It also shows other people within the intelligence community and the military, like, you know, if you give information, we're going to charge you with some capital offenses that can put you to death, which, you know, they said they don't want to put Bradley Manning to death, but a military judge reserves the right to declare whatever sentence he wants to. So, yeah, it acts as it's a punishment for him, and he's being made an example out of.
Occupy Wall Street sponsored a bus from New York City to Fort Meade, bringing about 50 participants to the rally. As Army helicopters flew overhead, Vietnam veteran John Penley used the well-known People's Mic to share a message from the General Assembly.
Bradley Manning is...
Bradley Manning is...
Part of the 99%...
Part of the 99%...
We will not stop...
We will not stop...
Until Bradley Manning...
Until Bradley Manning...
Is on the street...
Is on the street...
Camping with us...
Camping with us...
At an Occupy in this country...
At an Occupy in this country...
Saturday's rally was also in honor of Manning's 24th birthday. Solidarity actions were held around the world, from Sydney, Australia to Toronto. Manning's hearing continues through Wednesday or Thursday of this week, and a ruling on the case will likely come in spring of 2012. Alice Olstein, FSRN, Washington.
The last U.S. combat troops left Iraq over the weekend after 9 years of war that left nearly 4,500 U.S. soldiers and more than 100,000 Iraqis dead. Thousands more were injured and millions displaced. Much of the country remains in ruin. As physical rebuilding of Iraq continues, one organization has been trying to mend the relationships between ordinary Americans and Iraqis. Since 2004, the Iraqi and American Reconciliation Project in Minneapolis has been repairing cultural and ethnic damages from the war, one family at a time. The group has hosted 40 Iraqi professionals in Minneapolis in an effort to dispel stereotypes of Iraqi and American culture. FSRN's Joe Kadat caught up with some of the Iraqi doctors visiting Duluth and files this report.
In a small, dimly lit auditorium at the University of Minnesota, Duluth, 9 medical professionals from Iraq talk about the war with a handful of Duluth residents. Kufa College dentist Mahdi Al-Farahon is a resident of Najaf, Iraq. He says U.S.-led attacks on Najaf's infrastructure have left the city with a shortage of clean drinking water and access to only 6 hours of electricity per day.
They destroyed our ethics, they destroyed our education, they destroyed our lifestyle of in street, in schools, in hospitals. They destroyed everything. We are just a human like you. We need to work and to live, to love, to grow, upbringing our children, to get education, to improve our life.
Al-Farahon says many Iraqis despised Americans because of the war.
And until now, not seeing them as a human being. There is no respect between the American troops in Iraq and the Iraqi people. And if you go there, you see in your eyes a lot of examples. They cut the street, they shoot anybody unlike them, and nobody judged them.
But some of those perspectives changed for Al-Farahon after he joined the Iraqi and American Reconciliation Project. Al-Farahon says the kindness and compassion he's experienced in the U.S. changed his mind about the American people. He says he had no idea there were so many people in the U.S. who opposed the war in Iraq.
Actually, personally, I came to America to see the fathers of those soldiers in Iraq and to see how they are thinking. According to that, we saw also here is a big difference in thinking. But the media is not to transmit the facts in Iraq.
Concerned that the war was corroding relations between Iraqis and Americans, peace activists from Najaf in Minneapolis created the Iraqi and American Reconciliation Project in 2004. The group's communications director, Luke Wilcox, says it's a unique grassroots effort dedicated to dispelling ethnic and cultural stereotypes between Iraqi and U.S. citizens.
In terms of unraveling sort of the damage that's been done from war, whereas war tears down and breaks down those relationships, I think the shared experiences and doing things like hosting an Iraqi family in your home and really getting to know someone from Iraq or Iraqis getting to know Americans can really undo a lot of that tearing down that's happened through war.
Wilcox says many Iraqis and Americans see each other's society through the lens of war and associate it with violence. He says this program helps foster the rebuilding process by reducing hostility between cultures. 30 families in Minnesota have hosted professionals from Najaf over the past 7 years. One of them was retired medical technologist Cheryl Imdick. She says some of her family were concerned about Iraq being a misogynistic society, but those assumptions were soon challenged.
Just from a week of being with them, our eyes are opened. We get a stereotype of another country when you don't know the people and don't have a chance and don't have the media to see the people. You just go by what you hear and what you're feeling at that time. So I don't think you get to know a country, like I said before, unless you know the people.
For the Iraqis taking part, they also have new perspectives of American people. Kufa College of Medicine doctor Hadi Al-Wakil says when he goes back to Najaf, he'll tell his friends and colleagues that there's a big difference between Americans who supported the war and those who were against it.
So this trip will help so much to transfer the idea to our families and the family to the family that there is a big difference between the behavior of the troops in Iraq and the behavior of people in America. They are so kind, they are so sympathetic with us.
The Iraqi and American Reconciliation Project says it has improved relations between thousands of Americans and Iraqis. But those involved say efforts like this should be more widespread, educating more Americans about the impact of war and bringing the two cultures together. Although U.S. officials have declared an end to the war in Iraq, the Iraqi and American Reconciliation Project will continue its work. In March, 30 Americans will depart to Najaf, the biggest group they've ever sent to Iraq. Joe Cadot, FSRN, Duluth.
And thanks to Free Speech Radio News for bringing us those international headlines. Daily headlines and their full newscast can be found at their website at fsrn.org. We're going to take a quick break, but stay with us. You're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting live from the Student Union Building right here at UBC.
Want to know what's up at UBC? Read the UBC. It's only the largest student newspaper in Western Canada, and it's written and edited entirely by UBC students. The UBC is your source for on-campus news, culture, and sports. New editions come out every Monday and Thursday. For breaking news as well as amazing videos and blogs, check out ubc.ca.
And welcome back to News 101 on CITR 101.9. We now have your weekly weather forecast brought to you by CJ. Take it away.
Thank you, Martin. Well, the week doesn't look that bad, folks. It's getting slightly warmer and no sign of snow. Tonight, you've got slight showers, fog patches developing before morning. Temperatures steady near 6 degrees. On Tuesday, you have periods of rain ending in the morning, then clearing up a bit. Fog patches dissipating in the morning, becoming windy in the afternoon with a high of 8 degrees. Tuesday night is a few clouds, windy in the evening, and a low of minus 1. Wednesday is luckily sunny, with a high of plus 4, but chilly, so get your coats out if you haven't already. Thursday is cloudy, with a low of 0 and a high of plus 4. Friday is some rain, low of 0, but slightly warmer, with a high of 8 degrees. Saturday, periods of rain, low of plus 3, with a high of minus... the high of 7, that's not minus 7. And of course, Sunday, with slight showers here and there, with a low of plus 5 and a high of plus 8.
That's going to be Christmas.
Pretty much.
And 8 degree and raining Christmas.
Yeah. It's, I don't know.
It's balmy and sopping wet at the same time.
I'm just going to mix some whiskey with apple cider and drink it.
Happy day.
All right, that was your weekly weather forecast brought to you by me and Martin.
And that's our program for today, December 19th. Today's newscast was brought to you entirely by volunteer efforts. If you'd like to share your comments, get involved with the show, or give us a hot news tip, please contact us. Our phone number is 604-822-5334, or you can email news@citr.ca. You can subscribe to our podcast and listen to past shows at citr.ca. For more news, join us on Monday and Friday at 5 p.m. for another edition of News 101. I'm Martin Lemelin.
And I'm Chirag Mahajan.
Stay tuned for Sore Throats Clapping Hands with Robert, coming up right now at 6 p.m. Have a good night.